It is necessary to evacuate the area. Please leave the building immediately by the nearest exit.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Demonstrators killed in Iran over the New Year holiday, but why didn't the UK media report the police being shot? Libya, Syria, Ukraine, so why not Iran? Now, ISIS has been defeated by the Russians. Are the fighters being redeployed to Iran? 13 demonstrators were killed, as well as 3 Iranian police wounded and 1 shot dead, as so-called peaceful demonstrators were attacking army barracks, police stations and town halls in Iran. If violent demonstrators were to attack police and army in Britain, how would we react? And Yemen's Houthis, having killed their supposed ally, ex-President Saleh, go on to seize bank accounts of over 1,200 Yemeni officials, effectively taking over the government of the country and running the entire show. So was that what killing Saleh was really all about? And for weeks now, protests on the streets of Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities against corruption and bribery in the Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu, unreported here in the UK news. What is Netanyahu accused of? And also, Ibrahim Abu Turaya, an unarmed Palestinian paraplegic protester, shot dead by the Israeli Defence Force. And Charles Manson slipped away quietly to his final judgment over the holiday. Infamous US serial killer from the Process Church of the Final Judgment. Anton Chatkin explains Manson's malevolent monks may have originated here in the UK. Plus another passing, this time a good guy, Martin Summers' favourite Italian judge, Ferdinando Imposimato. Our sister show Dialect is supposed to be back here at BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday now, but you can be sure to catch it online. This week, John Hagedorn from the US 1001 Heroes blog, and also former Swiss-German banker turned All Smoke and Mirrors blogger Manfred Petrisch gives us his take on prospects for peace in 2018. We'll be hearing a little clip from that in a minute. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, hopefully, or you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. So let's start, Martin, with the big news of the day, which is Steve Bannon and his book about Donald Trump. All sorts of insults being thrown around here. Also, the possibility of Trump being impeached. It sounds like almost like the wagon train with the Indians starting to circle as we go into 2018.
Well, indeed. And Bannon, of course, was very close to Trump. So the fact that they've fallen out so publicly is quite... it's a development, let's put it that way.
I mean, is it Bannon just cashing in? I mean,
well, surely. No, Bannon represents the kind of more combative populist side of the Trump coalition, if we can call it that, and he's been edged out by Jared Kushner and the other more kind of establishment oriented
okay people. So what's the difference in these factions then?
Well, it's hard to work out. I mean, it's like watching they used to talk about Kremlinology, where people would watch who was lined up on Red Square on the podium on May Day to see who was in and who was out. We don't really know what's going on. I mean, this book has been
but written. We've had a team of people that won Trump the election, and then we've got another team of people who are now running the country.
Well, the point is that the team of people who win elections aren't necessarily the people who end up running the country in any case.
And we've seen slowly people being moved out.
There's some transfer between the two.
So anyway, what I'm trying to get from you is what's the big geopolitical changes going to come from that?
The big story is that Trump basically is being told what to do by the real power brokers in the US. And Bannon basically couldn't see eye to eye with those people, and therefore.
So is he right to speak out now, do you think? Yeah, he's seen all the dreams of the voters being slowly crushed.
I think some of the stuff in the book is very uncomplimentary towards Trump. And Bannon, of course, has now, burned his bridges with Trump, and Trump is basically accusing him of being a troublemaking. You know, they've not parted on good terms. And if you're against Trump, then this is all good news in one way. But I think the real problem is the shambles at the top in the United States of America is very dangerous as we go into an incredibly dangerous geopolitical situation globally.
What I'm trying to get at, Martin, is this someone making a bit of money and sticking the knife in the back, or is he doing the right thing by speaking out, having seen the changes from the 2016 election to what's happened?
Bannon is a big fool if he thinks that by electing Trump you're going to stop. He basically wants to have a more populist approach, but he's completely idiotic on.
So should he have been on Clinton's side then, Hillary Clinton?
No. The point is that none of these people actually know what they're doing. They're all over promoted. They're all not people who should be in charge, but they are, and that includes Bannon and it includes Trump.
Now, you remember we did that Donald Trump speech about his national security policy, didn't we, just before Christmas, which was quite entertaining to hear you fuming. But we also at the time, I was thinking, listening to him, he just sounds a little bit high. You know, he sounds like he's possibly even on cocaine or something. I mean, that may be nothing to do with that, but he just sounded like he was, he was doing this, and then he picked up the glass, didn't he? To take a drink with two hands and cradled it like a sort of small child. This is something going on with Trump, surely. He's not necessary. And what we're hearing from Michael Wolff in The Guardian today, he's saying, to quote Steve Bannon, he's lost it, that he's just simply not up to the job effectively.
Well, that's obviously the line that's being taken by Trump's opponents.
Is Trump up to the job?
Well, the question is whether, there's not a question whether he's up to the job or not. He's actually there. And he can't be got rid of that easily without a constitutional crisis. And that creates problems for anybody who's trying to deal with the United States of America in a negotiating situation, whether the North Koreans, the Chinese, the Russians, or whoever. Because as the Russians say, the problem with America is they're not agreement ready. Any deal we do with anybody there's no point doing deals because they're immediately removed. I mean, if you did deals with Trump couldn't deliver. It's quite clear he cannot deliver the US. His policy is being determined by the military in geopolitical terms, by Wall Street domestically. And the big tax cuts that he's just pushed through are going to do nothing for the disillusioned working class voters who voted for Trump. And of course, that was always going to be the way. I mean, that's what Bannon's complaining about.
Well, apparently the person behind all of this, Martin, apparently the person behind all this is someone called Rebecca Mercer. She's a billionaire and she backs both Bannon and Trump. And she's also backed something called Breitbart. Yes. So these billionaires, they can create out of nowhere
Mercer is her husband, who's the hedge fund manager. Yes, this is it. I mean,
aren't the hedge funds now effectively like the sort of medieval barons?
Well, except that the medieval barons, at least you knew where you were with them. They were the Duke of whatever or whatever. The hedge fund people might actually not have any money at all when it comes to the crash. They might end up with
But they've got it now, which is what counts. They can create media outlets. They can make presidents. They can get people like Bannon into the position there.
There's a huge, Trump wasn't the first choice of the establishment in the US. Some of them have reconciled themselves to the fact that he's there. Others haven't. Mike Pence is the vice president, and he is, of course, a completely, clockwork Republican tax-cutting militarist. And if Trump is removed through impeachment, what happens in the Constitution is Pence takes over, and Pence is just as bad, but with less charisma than Trump. I mean, nobody knows what he's like, so it would be much quieter in a way. Because one of the problems for Trump, and he really needs to think about this, is he goes on Twitter without consulting with anybody else first.
And what about this?
If I was him, I wouldn't go on Twitter. at all, but if I was going to go on Twitter, I'd certainly discuss with my senior advisors what I was.
Well, you know why he's going on Twitter, and that is because he doesn't believe the mainstream press in the US or anywhere else is saying what he's actually saying.
Okay,
he's saying that they basically twist his words.
Well, that's fair enough, but I still, if I was him, would have some advice about things before you start tweeting.
Yeah,
the thing is, you're then stuck with whatever you've said.
Well, like tweeting,
however stupid it is, you know?
Like tweeting Britain First, for example.
Indeed, and somebody else would have picked that up and said, "Oh, you do realise who these people are?"
What about relationships between the Russians and the Trump Council? That's one of the big subjects of this book, Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House.
Well, I mean, the one of the Bannon allegations is that he says it's treason that Kushner met with some Russian. Kushner met with the Russians on behalf of the Israelis to lobby the Russians not to oppose the American desire to recognise Israeli settlements in the West Bank. So in actual fact, the Trump regime was actually shilling for Israel when they met the Russians. So the idea that they should, and in any case, they're entitled to meet the Russians. They're entitled to meet anybody they want. The whole thing is a farce.
Strikes me like he's going to sell all these books anyway. Look, let's move on to some real news, which is the protests in Iran over the holidays, over several days. Now, three Iranian police were wounded. One policeman was shot dead, there were, I think, was it 15 demonstrators killed. So what do you make of these protests? It seemed to me interesting that it's just about the same time as we've had the demise of ISIS. Suddenly these sort of radicals of one sort or another are popping up in Iran. Is it any connection?
Well, it's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, there's also...
Because there's genuine grievances there.
Of course there are.
There's genuine grievances there, too.
That's hard to say, Tony. I mean, there's also been a bomb attack on a pipeline, supposedly claimed by a Salafist terrorist group linked to the Baluchis. But the Iranian government has said, no, that's actually made up. There wasn't an attack on a pipeline. And stuff I've seen on the internet this week shows pictures of protesters in Iran, or supposed protesters, tweeting pictures of demonstrations which are actually from Bahrain in 2012.
Yeah, and senior journalists in the US, I think it's Kenneth Roth, I think it was his name, tweeting pictures of tens of thousands of pro-government demonstrators saying it was the anti-government demonstrators.
Yeah, now there's two possibilities here. Either this is actually a colour revolution being orchestrated by CIA, MI6 and the Saudis, or it's genuine demonstrations on which they have then decided that they are going to try and manipulate.
Well, no one can argue that the economic conditions are very difficult.
Well, interestingly enough, the protests broke out in the most conservative parts of Iran, because the new regime of Rouhani, although it's liberal on social matters, is quite it's actually quite free market, and compared to what's gone on before, they are going to they've taken away subsidies on basic stuff for ordinary people. So these protests began in more conservative, poorer parts of Iran against the economic policy of the Rouhani government, which won the election on a policy in favour of the middle class in Iran. But nevertheless, the MEK, for example, who are a terrorist or freedom fighter group, take whatever name you want, they are calling for armed struggle against.
Don't they have the connection with the French state, actually?
The MEK have got a connection with Western intelligence services. It's well known. And of course, as you went to a conference about terrorism in Iran some while ago, and of course they've had over 17,000 deaths in Iran from terrorist attacks since the revolution, and these have been carried out by various groups subsidised and supported by the West. Now, that you've got to draw a distinction in any society between peaceful protests in favour of economic demands, and Rouhani himself has said, well, we're not trying to stop people protesting, but there is a line between that and burning things down, blowing things up and shooting at police officers. And I think the worry there's got to be is that what's happening here is very similar to what happened in Daraa in Syria at the beginning of the uprising there, which wasn't really enough. You got protests which didn't necessarily represent majority opinion, and then you had people shooting both protesters and police. And incidentally, on that point, in Kiev there is a a court case going on at the moment relating to the Bearcut riot police, who have been put on trial supposedly for killing the demonstrators in the Maidan Square before the uprising in Ukraine, and they have brought forward Georgian mercenaries who are based in Georgia, who are testifying on Skype, saying that they in fact killed the both police officers and demonstrators. And this is a standard pattern of NATO intelligence operations. And they also claim that their orders were given by a US colonel in uniform.
Anyway, also, I think it's amazing to see tens of thousands of people coming out pro-government demonstrators. I wonder how many pro-Theresa May demonstrators you get in London.
Well, indeed. And, of course, there was an election very recently in Iran. It wasn't an entirely free and fair election. Who has entirely free and fair elections? But the majority participated, and the majority voted for the more liberal candidate, Rouhani, rather than a more conservative candidate.
So I mean, I don't imagine, say, for example, Donald Trump would have got through the Iranian mullah's system for morality before he was allowed to stand for president, because they have this system, don't they? Where the mullahs basically filter people, and they say, you've done this in the past, you've been to prison, you can't become president.
And that's why some people say it's not a full democracy, because they can pre-vet the candidates. Nevertheless, the majority participated in the election. And if it comes to warfare and things like that, you've got to recognise that not entirely democratic systems may still have enough popular support to win a war.
So don't we have any vetting procedures for our candidates for elections in the West?
Well, indirectly we do.
We do, don't we? I mean, there's basically, it's called the deep state.
Well, yes, and also, of course, what happens in the West is people like Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy are assassinated. That's how things are settled over here.
Also in Israel, for weeks now, protests on the streets of Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities against corruption and bribery in the Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu, pretty much unreported here in Britain at all.
Yes, because we're too busy constantly. I mean, this is what Brian Eno calls prop agenda. So we've all heard about the protests in Iran, but we haven't heard about the protests in Israel, because that doesn't suit the narrative.
Netanyahu's former defence minister is predicting the Israeli prime minister will face charges of corruption. Moshe Yalon is predicting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be indicted on corruption charges, the subject of three separate investigations, one of which involves allegations he accepted lavish bribes from businessmen overseas, including Australian James Packer. Another involves accusations Netanyahu struck a deal with newspaper owner Amon Moses to tone down its attacks on Netanyahu in return for his influence on reducing the criticism of a rival paper. So these are basically, it's bribery effectively, isn't it?
Yeah, and the other thing that he's done is he's forced through the Knesset. The same sort of thing. In France, a sitting president cannot be prosecuted. But then, of course, you've got fixed terms in France. And the president can be prosecuted once they have, finished their term. Now, Netanyahu is just the leader of a political faction in the Knesset. He's the prime minister. And, there's no comparison, really. You know, Israeli politics is pretty corrupt, and Netanyahu's a pretty corrupt guy. And there's been a lot of protests about it. Because that people are on, and of course
they're happening every weekend now.
Well, but I mean, of course, the answer to what Netanyahu needs is an uprising in Iran and a war in Syria to distract everybody's attention from his.
Okay, I'll put a link up to these corruption charges and to some of the stories, because some of them actually do go into quite a lot of detail about why people are prepared to give up their time to stand in the street to protest against Netanyahu and the Likud party, which after all is a far right party, Martin, and effectively a racist party, which is introducing, by the way, this coming year into the Israeli parliament, effectively apartheid bill, which will make all Palestinians second-class citizens. We're taking away a lot of their rights.
Avigdor Lieberman, who's the defence secretary, has said, you know, we basically want to disenfranchise the Palestinians inside Israel and so on. And, of course, they're the only state in the world that's allowed to define their citizenship on the basis of you've got to be Jewish to be a citizen, or because it's a Jewish state. Now, you know, other people aren't allowed to do that. They're accused of being fascists if they come out with stuff like that. But the Israelis just get a special pass.
Yes, there's a good article on the Middle East Monitor to that. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Also, Martin, the Houthis killed their ex ally, President Saleh, before Christmas, and now they've seized bank accounts of over 1,200 Yemeni officials. So it seems like this is actually a lot of rivalry, a bit like the sort of armed version of what's been going on in the Labour Party, you know, the sort of civil war, effectively, within the Yemeni state that's fighting the Saudis. You know, they're two factions. One has decided to take the other one out, effectively.
Well, I mean, it's easy to say these things from a distance. Saleh was killed because he was going to try and make deals with the Saudis, which the Nasrullah, I'll call them, not the Houthis, because they've actually got a political party rather than, you know, the Houthis is just the ethnic orientation of those people, and Saleh was preparing to do deals with the Saudis, which they regarded as a sellout. And you know, it's hard for anybody who's not involved in a civil war to understand what the motivations are of people who are involved. And it's called a civil war, but in fact it's becoming a Yemeni uprising against Saudi invasion. But it's a horrible situation in which people are dying every day, and the British, of course, are involved.
Saleh was doing the right thing then in trying to bring an end to it.
Well, you could say that, but some would obviously argue the opposite, which is that he would then align with. Don't forget that the Nasrullah and Saleh had a pretty tempestuous relationship before all of this kicked off. They were fighting each other,
Didn't Saleh have access to quite a lot of the serious army equipment, which is what one of the he may have been behind this missile attack on Saudi Arabia just before he was killed.
Indeed,
so it's one of the only people.
There's been a further missile attack since Saleh was assassinated, and that implies that the Yemeni army are still fighting with the Nasrullah people. Now, it's very easy for... I mean, I do try and follow all these things, but we can't really, sitting here in a radio studio in Bristol, say that we know what's going on in the infighting and what's going on in Yemen. And it's absurd to suggest we do. This whole situation is completely wrong. Saudi Arabia should never have invaded Yemen.
No, I know, but what interests me in this is it looked like Saleh was the only person who had the equipment to actually hit back at Saudi Arabia, and now he's dead.
Well, that's not entirely true, because the Houthis have also been fighting, or the Nasrullah fighters have been fighting inside Saudi Arabia, across the border into Saudi Arabia. I mean, obviously, the thing that would be most helpful for the Yemenis is if they can keep united and keep the Saudis out. But of course, there are it's very complicated, as you can imagine. You've got lots of different groups with lots of different historical grievances against each other. North and South Yemen were only made into one country relatively recently.
Well, it's effectively a civil war, isn't it?
Well, yes, you could say it's a civil war, but with outside intervention. Yeah. And of course, the Saudis have got no business sticking
their
finger in.
Are the Iranians sticking their finger
into? No, the Nasrullah they're a different form of Shia from the Shia in Iran. And in any case, they've got their own agenda, which is to do with Yemen and nothing to do with anybody else.
Well, there's
else.
A small matter of a blockade, too.
Well, exactly. There's no way that anybody could get anything in there of that kind. And the Iranians, in fact, advised Nasrullah not to see Sana'a, the capital, but they took no notice because they've got their own agenda. And, the fact is that outside forces shouldn't be intervening, and that includes British outside forces, who are actually... I was reading that Scottish regiments have actually got people in Saudi Arabia training the Saudi coalition forces to fight in Yemen. We've got RAF personnel based in Riyadh who are helping this bombing campaign, which has killed tens of thousands of civilians, and they've got the biggest cholera outbreak since World War II on the back of...
Since long before that, yeah. Since medieval times.
Well, indeed, and we, our tax, you're talking about where's the money going to come from for John McDonnell to do this, that and the other. We're paying for that. We're paying for that slaughter. And of course, the military personnel involved have got to realise that your lives are possibly going to be forfeit here. If you go into Yemen and you get killed, then don't expect us to cry for you.
Anyway, I've been looking at prospects for 2018 geopolitically with the former Swiss-German banker Manfred Petrisch. He now writes a German language blog called All Smoke and Mirrors, or in German Alles Schau und Rausch, from his his home in Abkhazia on the Black Sea, and I spoke to Manfred just a couple of days ago about what he thought the prospects were for 2018. But I started by asking him about the potential, anyway, that the Nazis were involved in developing the atomic weapons, because he, in his younger days, had several conversations with former Nazi scientists, because his father was in Germany at the time and also a scientist. So he's in a position to know about things like that. Anyway, here's a short extract of my chat with Manfred Petrisch about geopolitics 2018 and Nazi nuclear weapons.
We all know, who have studied history about the Second World War, that it was the Soviet Union who defeated Hitler and the Third Reich, and not the West. You can see it just alone by the number of divisions that Germany used. They used 250 divisions against the Soviets and only 25 divisions against the West. So it's a 10-to-1 deployment of military forces between East and West. And still, the Soviets managed to absolutely destroy the German Wehrmacht. So what the West was up against was just a tiny fraction of the German forces. And the same applies, by the way, to Japan. It was the Soviets who actually defeated Japan by defeating an army of 1.2 million Japanese soldiers in Manchuria at the end of the war. And the Japanese actually capitulated because they were afraid that the Soviets were about to invade Japan. I mean, they were ready to invade Japan, and that's why they capitulated.
What about the German ability to build an atomic bomb? A lot of people have been saying that actually that was quite advanced during World War II.
I can tell you that I've spoken a long time ago with one of the scientists who was involved in this project, and they actually did two explosions, two atomic explosions during the war. One was done in the Lüneburger Heide, and one was done on one of the North Sea islands. They were comparatively tiny explosions. They were very far advanced. And the reason why the Americans with the Manhattan Project had a big problem, they didn't know how to ignite the atomic bomb. They didn't know how to ignite it. And that's why they had to wait until Germany was occupied and get the technology. That's why they were able to do the first explosion in July of 45. They had to wait until they got the technology from the Germans.
So was Churchill right to be worried about an atomic bomb being on the end of a V2 heading for London?
Absolutely, sure. But not only a V2. The Germans had the four-engine bombers who were able to hit New York. They would have been able to also hit the east coast of the United States.
So why didn't the Nazis use the atomic bomb if they had it then?
Because Hitler did not put much priority on that for some strange reason. He didn't prioritize the atomic weapon. Maybe he didn't understand it or something. He also didn't give much resources to this development.
So I guess the people of London in the 1940s and New York should be very glad that they didn't get nuked.
In a way, yes. Well, then the Japanese got it. The bombs were dropped on Japan.
Do you think there's any likelihood of a nuclear war with the North Koreans? Is that real or is it just rhetoric?
No, it's not real. Because if America does anything, then South Korea and also Japan is gone. There are 35,000 American soldiers in South Korea. They will be all dead.
Is there anything positive you see around the world for the next year, 2018?
Well, I see a positive. I see that China and Russia are working together, together with Iran, and also India is coming into play. They have definitely going away from the dollar as a dominant currency. What definitely is happening is that America is a declining imperium. You know, it's a declining power.
Aren't declining powers dangerous?
Sure, they are. They can think that maybe as a last resort, let's throw some bombs around the place. You see, the problem is that a lot of people are not taking America serious anymore. I mean, you saw it when Obama visited China. The Chinese didn't even roll out a set of stairs to his Air Force One plane. They didn't give him stairs so that he could step out of his plane. That means there is no more respect for America. It's lost a lot of its credibility, and especially now in regarding Syria. I mean, the winner is definitely Russia, and everybody knows what they can do now, right? I mean, what we have seen is that Russia used Syria to test its weapons, to improve the whole military. It was a testing ground, because there's always a difference between theory and practice. And they have used this war to show the world also what they're capable of. And their electronic capabilities are far beyond what the West can do. Electronic warfare, they are really number one in that area.
Well, that sounds a pretty accurate assessment of the positives in 2018. The more historical stuff, I think we'll let the audience make up its own mind what it thinks about that.
All I'll say is Manfred is in a position to know from indeed, his family
background. Indeed, it's worth hearing what he has to say. And, of course, his analysis of what's happening globally in 2018 is largely correct. The setting up of the Petro-Yuan in Shanghai is potentially a game-changer. Once people can actually buy oil using Chinese yuan, and they can change those yuan into gold, which is what's being suggested, then that's the writing on the wall for the dollar.
But I mean, what about the relationship between China and India, two massive countries?
That's a problematic relationship.
Yeah.
And, of course, what Narendra Modi did, who's the right-wing Hindutva leader of India, he brought in, 18 months ago now, this trying to get rid of cash in India, for goodness sake, where most people haven't got bank accounts. And, of course, it was largely disastrous and caused real problems for the poorest people in the country. But he did that with funding from the USAID, basically from the US government, to try and push this through. It didn't work, and it caused a lot of bad feeling. And it may be that Modi overplayed his hand there. But, of course, the US strategy is to try and use India to mess up China's potential to create the One Belt, One Road project through Asia and
will
Central
that happen?
Asia.
I mean, that's not really in India's interest. Surely their interest is to cooperate.
Well, in actual fact, it is in India's interest. They're part of the BRICS. They're part of the BRICS setup. It is in their interest, but you've got a pro-Western faction in India that wants to align with the US to try and keep China down, and so that you know that the tension is there. And Modi is effectively a US ally rather than.
And what's going to happen with Pakistan? Because we've seen that Trump turn against Pakistan.
Well, interesting. I was reading Andrew Karibko earlier, who's a very good analyst based in Moscow, about this. He's American, but he's based in Moscow, and he's saying, "Do you know what the Pakistanis have just?" They're going to do. There's 1.5 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan. They've just said that all of them have to go back within the next 30 days to Afghanistan. Now, of course, they're mostly Pashtun. They're mostly Taliban sympathetic. And they're all going to go back to Afghanistan.
I mean,
and, of course, there's no possibility that they can be easily integrated when they get back. So that's the counter.
Is this whole thing as simple as why Trump is getting annoyed with Pakistan? That they've been shooting his drones down, the American drones down, and said that the Americans aren't allowed to use the drones anymore in Pakistan?
Well, there's always been an ambivalent relationship between Pakistan and the US going back to the 1980s and the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. General Gul, for example, who's the head of the Insular Service, his intelligence agency, has always been pretty clear that he thinks that 9/11 was carried out by the Americans themselves, even though he was an ally of the Americans during the war in Afghanistan in the 80s. Now, the fact is that the Americans actually give Pakistan loads of military aid so that they can control Pakistan. Now, if Trump, in his idiocy, no doubt he'd not consulted with his general, said, "We're going to cut off aid to Pakistan," then the Chinese just say, "Good, off you go, we'll take over."
Also, I spoke to Manfred about the European Union and the Bilderbergs, because that was one of the first places I ever met Manfred, was at a Bilderberg conference in Dresden last year, and he was there to, because he thinks it's one of the most interesting places to go, and you can actually have a chat with some of the people that run the Western world, that is to say these 120 Bilderbergers, and so I just thought I'd get his take on what he, I suppose it's the deep state, what we were hearing about the mullahs over in Iran, filtering people who are going to run for political office. Effectively, Bilderberg is the equivalent here in the West, or one of them anyway. So let's see what Manfred had to say about them.
The Bilderberg was created by a Nazi. I mean, we know that Prince Bernhard was a member of the NSDAP, of the National Socialist Party. He was a member of the SS and SR. So the Bilderbergers were created by a Nazi and the president. So Bilderberg is actually a continuation of the Nazi ideology, which means one ruler, one empire, one everything. You know, that's how the EU was created. I mean, we know that the Bilderbergers created the EU also with this idea of one empire, one currency, one government, and so forth.
So do you have any agreement with people that say that actually the Nazi Party won the Second World War? They didn't lose at all?
Well, it depends how you see it. Military-wise, they lost it, but from an ideological point of view, they won it. You see, the Nazis didn't just disappear after the war. They just changed their tactics and said, well, if we can't do it through the Wehrmacht, let's do it through the economy. And let's create this economic union, and then we can take over Europe and have one currency and one ruler and one everything. So actually, the EU is just a continuation in another form of the Third Reich, right?
Well, that's a pretty controversial, I mean, it's something I've certainly temptation to agree with. But Martin, the reality on the ground is we've got an extremely aggressive foreign policy being driven by NATO and the United States, particularly in the Middle East. And, you know, the effects in Iraq and Syria have been appalling since the turn of the century.
I think that's right. And I think what Bilderberg represents is a rapprochement between the Nazi industrialists and the Western industrialists. And so you get this kind of mixed regime that we've got now, the Anglo-American Zionist regime, which basically took on board loads of Nazi operatives, like Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, becomes the head of the West German BND secret police. And, you know, from the Russian point of view, it's pretty obvious what's going on here. Most people in the West are totally oblivious. But, of course, the point is that these Nazis are integrated into the Western worldview. So what happened was is that certain Nazis are integrated into the Western setup, and then we're talking about Anglo-British imperialism. The American-British control of the world economy via naval power, linked with the Germans, and of course the enemy of all of these people is the Russians and the Chinese, and you know the basic geopolitics of the situation haven't changed much in 50 years.
Okay, so we had on the show a couple of months ago a chap called Alexander Azadgan from California. I think he was at a university in California, and he prompted me to get hold of this, and I watched it at the time, which is a documentary about his book, not his book, but a book by John Perkins called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. So I thought we'd have a listen to John Perkins now, talking about the tactics and the background. Step back a minute from what happened with Tony Blair in Iraq. How on earth did it take place? Well, John Perkins has his story to tell.
Iraq actually is a perfect example of the way the whole system works. So we economic hitmen are the first line of defense. We go in and we try to corrupt governments and get them to accept these huge loans, which we then use as leverage to basically own them. If we fail, as I failed in Panama with Omar Torrijos and in Ecuador with Jaime Roldos, men who refused to be corrupted, then the second line of defense is we send in the jackals. And the jackals either overthrow governments or they assassinate. And once that happens and a new government comes in, boy, it's going to toe the line because the new president knows what will happen if he doesn't. But in the case of Iraq, both of those things failed. Economic hitmen were not able to get through to Saddam Hussein. We tried very hard. We tried to get him to accept a deal very similar to what the House of Saud had accepted in Saudi Arabia, but he wouldn't accept it. And so the jackals went in to take him out. They couldn't do it. His security was very good. After all, he had one time worked for the CIA. He'd been hired to assassinate a former president of Iraq and failed, but he knew the system. So in 91, we send in the troops and we take out the Iraqi military. So we assume at that point that Saddam Hussein is going to come around. We could have taken him out, of course, at that time, but we didn't want him. He's the kind of strong man we like. He controls his people. We thought he could control the Kurds and keep the Iranians in their border and keep pumping oil for us. And that once we took out his military, now he's going to come around. So the economic hitmen go back in the 90s without success. If they'd had success, he'd still be running the country. We'd be selling him all the fighter jets he wants and everything else he wants. But they couldn't. They didn't have success. The jackals couldn't take him out again. So we sent the military in once again, and this time we did the complete job and took him out, and in the process created for ourselves some very, very lucrative construction deals. We had to reconstruct a country that we'd essentially destroyed, which is a pretty good deal if you own construction companies, big ones.
That's John Perkins there, author of the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and I'll put a link up to that fascinating interview, sort of mini documentary about him. That's why you heard the music in the background there. Martin, it's a pretty cynical way of dealing around the world, where you just have a series of, basically, you send in your assassins, this kind of thing, if a particular president doesn't do what you tell him.
Yeah, it's pretty. I mean, it's well known that this is the way the world works for those who pay attention, and underlying all of this is not so much the Fourth Reich as we were talking about earlier. It's a continuation of the British Empire's desire to control world trade and all the rest of it. The US have taken over that.
I mean, isn't it even more aggressive than the British Empire?
It is. Yes. I mean, if you think about, since Thatcher and Reagan came to power, millions, literally millions, of people have been put to the sword in developing countries in order to enforce the will of Wall Street and the Pentagon.
And at the back of it all apparently is the economy, and yet the dollar is on the way out.
Well, the dollar isn't on the way out yet, which is why the stock market in the US, I mean, we didn't mention this, but stock markets all over the world reached the end of 2018 on the highest ever, and they've even gone up further since then. All of which is based on the idea that they're not going to try and balance the books in the US. The dollar is the world's reserve currency, so they can print any amount of dollars they like, and they can just do what they want, and everybody's just going to go along with it. The problem with all of that is that ultimately the dollar is going to crash, and when it does, the US is going to be in chaos.
Well, one of the kind of precursors to all of this in the 1990s was the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. Who were the main outside players there, Martin?
Well, the main outside players were the Western powers, as always.
Surely the Iranians had a role as well.
Well, the Iranians at one stage were being encouraged. I was actually, Iranian Mujahideen were on a bus with me going to Tuzla in the 1990s, and I then came home to walk into my office to find a fax on my desk from the Foreign Office saying, on no account go anywhere near Tuzla, because the Iranian Mujahideen are going to try and capture a British aid worker. And I just had to laugh because I'd just been on the bus strapping.
Try and capture you?
No, they didn't. So they ignored me. I suppose they didn't even know I was British, I suppose. But they were being used at that stage, because at that stage we were all in favour of the poor Muslims who were being persecuted by the Serbs, and we've got to intervene to protect the Muslims. Now, of course, the Muslims are all terrorists, and we mustn't have anything to do with them. But I mean, this is the dizzying change of propaganda that comes out of the Western system.
But I mean, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that Yugoslavia didn't just fall apart. This is a bit of history that was made to happen.
Well, all right. Well, I mean, if people want to look at my old book, which came out in 1998, called Market Failure, Eastern Europeans' Economic Miracle, there's a whole chapter about the collapse of Yugoslavia in there. But one of the problems with it was that the Germans were pushing for quick recognition of their allies.
But, okay, so you say collapse, but wasn't it, surely it was destroyed from outside? It didn't just collapse.
Fundamentally, to the destruction of Yugoslavia was the fact that they got into debt in the 1970s onwards. And of course, once you're in debt, they were the most open of the Eastern European
economies.
Maybe
the economic hitmen came in to visit on holiday, huh?
And of course, eventually, once they were in debt, they were then forced to actually repay the debt, which of course you're never going to do. And by doing that, they then have to cut public expenditure.
Can't they just cancel the debt?
you could walk away from the debt, and people have tried, but then of course that's a very provocative thing to
then
do.
Then you get hundreds of jackals will come and find you then.
And there's a reason. I mean, Alan Garcia, who was president of Peru in the early 80s, tried to say we're not going to pay the debt, and of course he paid the price. He was removed, and eventually they were begging that to be allowed back.
Well, what happened in Argentina? Because that was another massive collapse.
What happened in Argentina is you've got a right wing government that's come to power.
Talking about 90, it was around about 2000, wasn't it? Yeah. They had a complete and utter reset of the economy.
Yeah, well, what happened was that they'd been forced to accept a court in New York insisted that vulture funds that had bought up the debt should be paid in full, even though everybody else had agreed to have a write down. And then the Argentinians have been forced to swallow that. If you're a weak player in this game and you're being bullied, you can't just say we're not going to pay, because you're going to be made to pay one way or the other. You've got to be big and strong if you're going to stand up to them. You've got to be China, you've got to be Russia, or one of their allies.
Okay.
If you try and fight them on your own, you're just going to be crushed.
Back to Yugoslavia, before we leave it completely, let's have a chat to, well, let's hear from James Blissett, who's the former Canadian ambassador to Yugoslavia, who he thinks was responsible for that.
It hasn't changed. I've always said that those who start the war should be held responsible. And in my view, the people that started the war, the government that started the war, was the United States. There was a referendum in Bosnia about independence, and that was defeated. And my neighbor, who was the U.S. ambassador in Belgrade, who lived across the street from me, when an agreement was signed by all three religious groups that there would be peace in Bosnia and no declaration of independence without all three representatives being part of that, my neighbor, the U.S. ambassador, Warren Zimmerman, went to Sarajevo and convinced the Muslim leader, Izet Begovic, to declare unilateral independence. And that he did, of course. And that was what started the war, because the 39% or 40% of the Serbian population there refused to accept the idea of living under Muslim law or Sharia law by the Muslim leadership. So the story goes back in history, of course, because mm-hmm. those Serbs had been subject of the Islamic Turkish Empire for many centuries and had fought to free themselves from that. They did not want, in the middle of the 20th century, to once again have to live under Muslim rule. And that meant war. And everybody in the Balkans knew that meant war if the Muslims' declaration of independence was declared.
John Bissett.
So, you know, who really started the war?
Who really started the war? It has been a pleasure speaking with you. John Bissett, former Canadian ambassador to Yugoslavia. Thank you for your time on this day. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty accurate. The fact is that at the time, it was not quite clear who was doing what or why, and it was all very confusing. But with hindsight, it's pretty clear that Yugoslavia was deliberately destabilised by Western powers. And I spoke to a guy who was the former foreign minister of Bulgaria in Sofia while I was working in the region. And after a conference, we were chatting in the bar afterwards, and he said, "You do realise that the Americans have rigged all this to happen?" And I said, "No, they've been very incompetent. They've bungled it. They've made a complete mess of it." He said, "No, it's not just that. They've actually deliberately created the chaos here." And at the time, I was in my 30s, I thought, no, he's missed the, you know, he's too conspiratorial. They've made a mess of it, and we could go into the reasons why, but I didn't think that they'd done it deliberately. But now, with hindsight and years later, I think it's pretty clear that they did do it deliberately because of everything that's happened since.
Well, he slipped away quietly in his final judgment over the holiday. Infamous US serial killer from the Process Church of the Final Judgment, Charles Manson. Here's Anton Chakhin, the US-based writer, explaining Manson's malevolent monks may have originated in Britain here.
In 1974, there was a young student at Stanford University who was 19 years old. He was from North Dakota. His name was Bruce Perry. And he had a lovely young wife, 19 years old, also from North Dakota. She's also a student at Stanford, and they're living in student housing for married couples. And one night, his wife was brutally murdered in the church at Stanford University, in the college chapel. It was a satanic ritual killing, and I'm not going to describe the details. It's very gruesome and disgusting. And it was the body was arranged in a ritual fashion and so forth. Everybody was totally shocked. The police went to this guy's house or apartment to inform him about the murder. He comes to the door and he's covered with blood. He said it was a nosebleed. And when they tested the blood, supposedly it was not his wife's blood type. The murder was never solved. This Bruce Perry went on to become a famous psychiatrist. He is the head of the Baylor University Medical Psychiatric Operations in Texas. He is a national spokesman for the theory that there is no such thing as satanic ritual crimes. Now, this is extremely perturbing, not only because of what happened to him, but because the murder of his wife became perhaps the most famous satanic crime in American history, because it was the opening scene in a book called The Ultimate Evil, written by Maury Terry. In that book, Maury Terry, who was a newspaper man up in New York, got onto that murder by interviewing a guy who was in jail for committing some other murders, a guy named David Berkowitz, who was arrested as the Son of Sam killer in New York City. He'd supposedly killed a bunch of people in New York for no reason. He said, supposedly told the press, there's an evil dog who told me to do this. Well, then when they got into interviewing him, he said, well, actually, I took the fall for this group that I'm in. It's called the Process Church of the Final Judgment. The Process, hyphen, Church of the Final Judgment. And he said, he told Maury Terry, by the way, this woman, Arliss Perry, was killed by people in this cult when she interfered with what they were doing. And Charles Manson was in it, too. And his whole ideology comes from this. Now, what is this thing? This is a British group that came over from England to America in the 1960s, and it's still around, headquartered now in Canada. But this was a satanic cult. And this guy, Bruce Perry, whose wife was killed by them, is now a lecturer for the Cult Awareness Network. And he spoke at their November conference in Minnesota as an expert on what happened at Waco, Texas. The reason he knew all about that was that the FBI hired him as their expert on David Koresh. Because he is an expert on on sex crimes against children.
Has experience with that, huh?
Yeah, he has a lot of experience in this field of some type. I don't say anything about what happened to him. I don't know. Was he in on his wife's murder? I don't say that. I just know that he's now protecting those who killed his wife. The interesting thing about this is that when you dig a little bit behind these organizations, you find that the Cult Awareness Network is run by the same people who run the satanic cult. The same people. There's a group of foundations and law firms in New York City that fund the Cult Awareness Network and the American Family Foundation. And the same people are the lawyers and protectors and interveners for the cult, Process Church of the Final Judgment.
So that was Anton Chatkin talking about the now deceased Process Church of the Final Judgment, and the actual chap, of course, is Charles Manson, who was part of that, who died over the holidays. Anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Now coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Labour councillor for St George Troopers Hill, Fabian Breckles, and also former independent candidate for Mayor, John Langley. Close associate of writer and campaigner Steve Norman, who passed away over the holiday. Also to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is onewordthisweek.org. UK. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. with Billy Quain, Saturday edition tomorrow morning at 10, and The Real Musical Deal Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. I'll leave you with music from 91. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. If not here, then online. This is Quasar, Quazar. Fast forward. God bless, and don't the banks, let the banksters get you down.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.